Can You Dig It? With Dr. Craig Barker.
When is a discovery too good to be true? Fakes and forgeries in the archaeological world aren't anything that's new, but Can You Dig It? With Dr. Craig Barker is going to take a look at the world of hoaxes and those discoveries that even the professionals started to believe were true. Now, Craig, what is the history of the archaeological hoax? I mean, do we know what the first hoax was?
Well, no. Long and short, no. But while ever humans have been collecting objects that have some degree of antiquity, and for this case we are going back to antiquity, we know that, you know, there were museums in the classical world. We know there's an amazing discovery in the Agora of Athens of dinosaur bones that were obviously collected without necessarily knowing what they were. And again, we have historical records of earlier kings in the Middle East and so on actually collecting objects that were associated with predecessors and so on. So while ever there's been a financial value associated with heritage material, or the other thing, of course, is a cultural value or a political value as well. The idea of faking and forging has been at the centre of any type of archaeological investigation, and hence the reason why, as an academic discipline, over the decades, we've developed this strength of understanding the provenance. Where the object comes from is what's going to dictate, you know, its knowledge about its age, about its association with other artifacts. But even in scenarios with provenance, there are cases of where, you know, archaeological material has been salted. A good example of this is the Nazis in the 1930s. The Germans would lead archaeological excavations in various parts of Eastern Europe. This is before the outbreak of World War II. And, you know, I've seen stock footage of, you know, excavators troweling away and then finding pottery objects from the Bronze Age, turn them upside down, and there's a swastika on the bottom of them. That was being used by the German propaganda machine as proof that, you know, these people were Germanic. It's only a matter of time before it becomes reincorporated again. So the way that history can be manipulated can be used in all sorts of different ways. I think in many ways the real birth, within the Western world anyway, the real birth of fakes and forgeries and hoaxes of historical material, though, is from the Middle Ages, and it's particularly associated with early Christian relics and holy relics and so on. So that's kind of where it began in many ways. But during the 20th century, there's been a really, really interesting switch in terms of a lot of the more higher profile cases have really been driven by financial gain, as opposed to this desire to actually have something which is, in the case of the Middle Ages, an object that has a religious significance or some sort of cultural or historical significance, if that makes sense.
So, Craig, do you think that it's getting harder to have forgeries, to have hoaxes with the technology that we have today? Or is it a case where the technology, those making the fakes and the forgeries are still keeping up with the technology?
Oh, yeah. It's like any criminal activity that no matter what the improvements are in terms of policing, they're always one step ahead. I think in the 21st century, the fact that you do have so many dating techniques available, which can prove or disprove the antiquity of an object, I think that has been one of the key tools in terms of us being able to definitively prove whether something's genuine or something's fake. But bearing in mind that in many cases cultural institutions, you know, have invested a lot of money in purchasing an object, so they don't want it to be proved to be faked, even if they do have suspicions themselves in some cases. The other thing is yes, there are scientific methods, but these are quite expensive. So, you know, and in some cases destructive as well. So do you actually want to spend a lot of money causing some degree of damage to an object to actually disprove that it's a modern forgery as well? So there are all sorts of complications as well. And as we were talking about before in the news segment, the fact that the market has been revolutionized by the fact that, you know, so many objects can now be purchased online, and you know, so many antiquities can be purchased online, that how do you actually test every single one of those 100,000 objects at any one time? So it's a difficult scenario, and it's kind of interesting. The cases that we're going to talk about, the case studies that we've looked at are interesting because they've kind of captured the public imagination, or there's been a huge scandal involved with it. But this is really only the tip of the iceberg in many ways. And I think, again, going back to that story of medieval fakes, that, you know, the fact that so many different churches across Europe claim to have so many different holy relics, or, you know, so many different parts of the Holy Cross, for example, that I think somebody estimated that if you actually added up all the bits of wood in various parts of churches, the Holy Cross itself would have been, you know, meters and meters high and wide and so on. So, you know, it can't all be genuine. So how do you actually ascertain what is and what isn't?
Well, Craig, one of the cases you want to take a look at is the Piltdown Man. And who was the Piltdown Man?
Well, the Piltdown Man is probably the most famous archaeological hoax of all time, because to some degree they got away with it for 40 years. And indeed, until very recently, there was much speculation as to who perpetrated it. And one of the key things of all of these stories is, yes, it's great that you're causing a hoax or you're creating a hoax, but who's doing it and why are they doing it? For financial purposes, most cases, but in some cases to disprove, you know, colleagues, or to try and disprove those know-it-all scientists and so on. So it's kind of interesting. But the Piltdown story really did capture the imagination in 1912 when it was first announced. And there's several reasons for that that we'll go into. But the fact that it really took more than four decades to analyse and understand that it was, and prove that it was a fake, and the fact that it's really only been in 2016 that we now know how the fake, the forgery took place, is remarkable. So it's a century-long scandalous story. And a Piltdown hoax, or Piltdown man, was a discovery made in a quarry in Piltdown in East Sussex by an amateur anthropologist called Charles Dawson in 1912. He claimed that he found this prehistoric skull in the quarry site, took it to Arthur Smith Woodward, who was then Keeper of Geology at the Natural History Museum. The story goes that the two of them analysed, but certainly Smith Woodward spent a lot of time looking at it, pronounced that this was genuine, and indeed from a geological perspective was from a context that was half a million years old. When Dawson presented the findings at the Geological Society, you know, massive acclaim, a standing ovation, and the skull was presented as a new type species for a new species of early human history called Eoanthropus Dawsoni. So, of course, you know it's got to be genuine when you have an artifact named after yourself,
exactly.
A specimen named after yourself. And as I said, it's not until 1953 that it's finally exposed as a hoax. Some of the greatest scientific minds of the early 20th century examined the Piltdown skull, and they all walked away, or actually I should say most of them walked away, believing it was a genuine ancient early human ancestor. The missing link was how it was described at the time. We're talking about people like Sir Grafton Elliot Smith, who was an Australian, one of the great medical forensic investigators of his era, Arthur Conan Doyle, the famous creator of Sherlock Holmes, for example. How did you get away with faking these people? Because what it actually was a modern human skull, slightly smaller than average, a chimpanzee, an orangutan a jawbone, and chimpanzee teeth that had been filed down. So it's actually quite an obvious fake once you know what it is. But, you know, they got away with it for a long time. Then the big question became, who did it? Now, I should actually say that at the time of the announcement, you know, the Royal College of Surgeons, for example, did actually raise some doubts in 1912. A landmark study in 1923 by a guy called Franz Weidenreich actually suggested, it's just a modern skull and an orangutan jaw, and his study was completely ignored, but he was right. They got away with it. And in large part, they got away with it because, firstly, access to the skull was relatively limited. So, the best and the brightest did look at it, but only a small number of scholars did actually get to look at it. So that was the first thing, that there wasn't a great deal of opportunity for dissenting voices, which I think is one of the great advances in the 21st century, is that, you know, by peer-reviewed publishing, a lot of the more marquee discoveries of the last couple of decades have been very, very criticised, and for good reason, because part of it is actually making sure that this is genuine evidence, that, you know, that all of the ducks do line up. But the other interesting thing, of course, was that it fits perfectly within its Edwardian context, that, you know, here is proof that the earliest human on Earth wasn't just, from one of the countries in the British Empire, but was from East Sussex. You know, it was an Englishman. It's also interesting. I mean, in the initial study, Smith Woodward said that the skull could be either male or female, but immediately there's a real, chauvinism about it, because he was always published as being the Piltdown man. The one exception was the Daily Express newspaper, who was using it who described it as the Piltdown woman, but they were using that to mock the contemporary suffragette movement as well. So there's a real misogyny about the way that it was being presented as well, which was very much keeping within that colonial perspective as well. So who actually did it? And it's kind of interesting because...
Tell me the Australian wasn't involved.
No, but he was. But Grafton Elliot Smith was actually pointed. I mean, basically, a bit like Jack the Ripper, that anybody who's written a book on the Piltdown hoax has come up with an alternative suggestion as to who did it. Once it was proved using scientific analysis in 1953 that it was faked, anyone who touched it suddenly became a key suspect. So Grafton Elliot Smith was accused at one point in time. It's clearly not him. Arthur Conan Doyle, as I mentioned before, was accused. For decades, it was always suggested that the most likely scenario was that it was actually Charles Dawson himself who faked it. We now know that within his private collection, something like 38 of the specimens that he'd collected in the decades before were faked as well. So one suggestion was actually put forward that it was members of the Sussex, community of anthropologists who knew what Dawson was doing and tried to outforge the forger themselves, which is an interesting scenario and certainly could be the case. Where that particular theory becomes interesting too is that the fossilised elephant bone, and I'm using quotation marks as I say that, that was found alongside the skull was at the time remarked as looking like the shape, it looked like it had been shaped like a cricket bat. So what better way to prove, the British colonial ideal of superiority, that the world's first Englishman was also a cricket player as well too. It's kind of interesting the way that it was really presented, but nobody picked up on it at the time. It's even the more remarkable. Woodward's book, by the way, his study was published in 1948, so long after he'd passed away, but it was titled The Earliest Englishman, so clearly fitting in with this colonial perspective. But in 2016, after quite a few years of very, very rigorous review, a study was published which actually reveals the method of the forgery. It's obviously the hand of one person. There's all sorts of... we now know how the acid stains were applied to the skull to give it a sense of much greater antiquity than it was. The way that dental plaster was actually used for shaping the jawbone and so on. So I think you can probably say with some degree of certainty, sort of 98% certainty, that it was Charles Dawson himself who perpetrated the hoax. Why he did it, we probably will never know. But again, he got massive acclaim. Here we are, 104 years later, and we're still talking about him. So
very true.
maybe that's all he wanted was that fame. But Piltdown hoax is the great warning for all of us, and particularly in terms of the study of early human hominid behaviour, because the media fell into that whole frenzy of the missing link. And of course, our gradual knowledge of human evolution proves there's not one great missing link, but a much, much complicated story, the more complicated story of connections and interlinking of various branches of the human family tree.
I'm Rhianna Patrick. This is ABC Radio, and Can You Dig It with Dr. Craig Barker is delving into the archaeological world of hoaxes, fakes, and forgeries. Now, this is an interesting one, Craig, which is the Cardiff Giant. I mean, what do we know about the Cardiff Giant?
Well, the Cardiff Giant, I think, is a clear case of what began as a personal vendetta and someone making a personal statement, but became very quickly a financial forgery. And indeed, it is has a very close connection with P.T. Barnum, so I think you know which way this one's going to go. The Cardiff Giant was a 3-metre-high stone petrified man, a petrified giant that was found in October of 1865 on a farm just outside of Cardiff in upstate New York. And it was created by, and the entire hoax was actually created by a New York tobacconist called George Hole. Now, Hole himself was an atheist and got into an argument, of all the reasons to actually perpetrate a hoax, got into an argument at a Methodist revival meeting about a passage in Genesis, the book of Genesis, which stated that there were giants who once lived on Earth. And so he went out to disprove all of these evangelical believers that, you know, it can't have been the case. And what he did was he bought a massive, massive block of gypsum from Iowa, employed a sculptor to shape it into a man, and then had it buried on the farm of a distant relative. A couple of years later, the farmers conveniently dug a well and found it, and then started charging. By the way, he spent around about $2,000, which at the time would have been around about $50,000 in contemporary money. So it was quite an expensive hoax to try and perpetrate.
Yeah, just to one-up someone.
Just to one-up someone in a theological argument of all things. But the family very quickly began charging, you know, 50 cents per people to come and this, you know, look at the prehistoric giant. They ended up selling the body, quote unquote, to a consortium. The consortium themselves, and by the way, the giant still exists. It's currently on display in the Farmers Museum in New York, if anyone wants to go and see it. But the consortium themselves were actually approached by Barnum, P.T. Barnum, wanting to buy it, and they refused. And so Barnum went off and actually had his own one made, and charged people admission to see that, and said that the Cardiff giant was the fake and that his was real. So there's actually two Cardiff giants, if that makes sense. Of course, the famous story about the quote's attributed to Barnum, but it was actually said about Barnum that there's a sucker born every minute. Once the consortium heard the price that Barnum was charging, which was considerably more than they were for people to go and see this prehistoric giant, the head of the consortium said, oh, there's a sucker born every moment. So it's really, really interesting because it's pure financial gain in this particular case.
Craig, just so you know, I'd be one of those people paying money to see that.
I've got to say, when you see photos of it on the internet, I've not had the privilege of going to the Farmers Museum in New York, but the next time I'm in the States, I must say, preparing for tonight, I suddenly thought, yeah, I want to see this now.
Now, this next one is quite an interesting one, and I feel like they felt that their country's history was at stake with this, but what was the Japanese Paleolithic hoax?
Yeah, now this is actually a very sad story in many ways. It's the story of a very prestigious archaeologist until the scandal broke. Japanese archaeologist, prehistorian called Shinichi Fujimura. Began as a student amateur archaeologist in the 1970s. And at that point, even before he becomes a professional, he's salting lower and middle Paleolithic finds onto sites. So he's actually burying things in the ground. Of course, during his rise in his career in the 1980s and 1990s, where he ends up becoming the head of one of the major Japanese prehistoric archaeological organizations, he's involved with over 150 projects. And what he's doing is actually he's planting fake evidence making discoveries. Initially sort of stone pottery ware, stoneware that his team would have dated it being about 40,000 years old. So basically trying to push Japanese civilization, the date of earliest Japanese occupation of the Japanese islands back and back and back. And eventually, like the Piltdown hoax, over 500,000 years of human occupation, and, you know, going off on all sorts of bizarre things, like even early architectural ruins and so on. Now, where it gets interesting, of course, is that his professional colleagues should have been picking up on, you know, it's rather interesting, these finds are only being found on his sites, not on anyone else's. But such was his reputation, and, of course, the whole Japanese relationship of not questioning the expertise of your superiors and so on, just exacerbated and exacerbated and exacerbated. And he only came undone in the year 2000 when one of the Japanese newspapers actually filmed him planting objects that were going to be dug up the next day. And again, much, much soul searching. The National Museum of Tokyo had to remove more than 20 artifacts from public display that, you know, he'd found and that were supposedly proof of this early prehistoric occupation on the island. So it's kind of interesting now, with the benefit of sort of 15 years or so since the scandal broke, that, that you know, in many ways, Japanese prehistory still hasn't really recovered from the shame and the scandal of not just him doing it, but not picking it up. And in many ways, the really interesting thing is, what, you know, why was he doing it? Because he was getting no financial gain out of it whatsoever. Indeed, it ruined his otherwise respectable reputation. It seems to be he just wanted Japan to have a much earlier prehistory than it actually did.
Look, we all feel that, don't we, Craig? You know, not everyone can be Australia.
No. But it's interesting enough as it is the issue. So why why fake it?
it was a really sort of sad, you know, going from a well-respected archaeologist to then no one believing anything that you'd found prior.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
Very much so.
Can You Dig It with Dr. Craig Barker is taking a look at, you know, the hoaxes, the fakes, the forgeries in the archaeological world. And Craig, I might just ask you about, you know, we could continue talking about hoaxes all night, but I wanted to find out what your top three finds of 2017 were.
Well, it's been a really interesting year.
Yeah.
Archaeologically, there's been a lot of the stories that we've talked about over the months have been, you know, things that have really captured public imagination. Some have been a little bit more obscure. One of the ones that we talked about earlier in the year, I think it was around about August, was the project just to the south of Lyon in France, where the French archaeological teams have been investigating near Vienne pretty much an entire Roman neighbourhood, a very large part of a city. It's being described in the press as Little Pompeii, but I think what's important about it is the scale of the urban nature of this Roman settlement of the 1st and 2nd centuries AD, like the real Pompeii, just gives a remarkable insight into domestic and urban life. And I think that there will be decades of research come out of this. It's more than 7,000 square metres of a housing complex excavated to date. And remember, the project's only new. So, like Pompeii, has the potential for decades and decades of future research. So it will become a major, major archaeological project of the future. The second one I just thought I should mention in passing is actually a story that you found too, Ree, but the announcement in February of a project led by a veteran archaeologist who's been working in Sudan, a guy called Charles Bonnet, been working in Sudan for more than five decades. But
I really liked this story.
Well, it's great, isn't it? Because yeah. It's also that we all kind of fall into our particular areas of interest and research, and just the passion just keeps on driving us back and back and back again to the same places. It's near a place called Kema, and the project that he's involved with has recovered around about 1,500 to around about 2,000 BC. A series of oval and round temples. And basically, yeah, there's been work taking place in the Sudan, archaeological work taking place in the Sudan for decades. But one of the things that Bonnet's team is doing is really throwing a spotlight on a region that's often been unfairly overshadowed by Egypt to the north and by the famous Kingdom of the Kush further south, closer to where Khartoum. And as he says in this remarkable article, you know, it's an extraordinary part of the world, and it's extraordinary history that maybe after some years we'll be able to talk about Sudanology in the same way that we talk about Egyptology. So I think it's just one of those things of a lovely story of someone dedicated their professional career to not just trying to understand an ancient culture, but to really promote it on a much broader circle. So, yeah, lovely, lovely story.
And Craig, speaking of, you know, pushing it back a little bit further, Australia did get pushed back a little bit further with your third top find of 2017.
The third one is, and again, with all of these, they're not new discoveries. And I think it fits in with what we were talking before about the fakes and the forgeries, that the media are often looking for the brand new thing. And in many ways, the most interesting stories in terms of, you know, archaeology, like all sciences, is a long, slow, laborious
process
of reinterpretation.
Looking for a needle in a haystack.
Absolutely. The most interesting finds are always under the dig house. They're always found on the last day and things like that as well. So this is in the Northern Territory at Malacuna 2 is the name of the site. It's a rock cave. It's been investigated since the 1980s. It's been very well known in Australian prehistoric circles, but with the announcement in Nature in the middle of this year of confirmation of dating of human occupation of this particular shelter site back to 65,000 years. Really, this pushes the ancestry of Australia's occupation by the first Australians back decades further than we'd had previous scientific proof. I think it's only a matter of time before we go back even further. But what's interesting about this is that it's I think, representational of a much greater interest in the Australian media and mainstream Australia, full stop, in terms of wanting to know more about the deep, deep ancestry of Aboriginal Australia. So I think the more that these types of sites are talked about, the more they're analysed by us on a professional level as an academic discipline, but the more that people on the street are actually talking about 65,000 years and so on, really makes people appreciate the long and varied history that we have in our own country. And it's a remarkable, remarkable find.
Well, Craig, we are going to pick up Can You Dig It next year in 2018. You will be back. And, Craig, thank you so much for coming in each month of this year to have a chat and to take us through not only archaeological news, but also, you know, we've done so many different topics this year. It's been a lot of fun.
It has. Thank you so much for having me on. And we've got some good things planned for next year already. So can't wait to share that with our listeners.